Hey, Ghost Machine fans, this one's for you. Welcome to the second episode of the Ghost Machine Fans Podcast. It has been quite the week. We had three brand new ongoing series come out. We're going to talk about each of those books, try to spend 10 to 15 minutes apiece on them. That being said, if you're here, we assume you have read Redcoat number 1, Rook Exodus number 1, and Geiger number 1. If you haven't done that, I would highly recommend pausing the podcast and going and reading those books. And hey, listen, if you're one of those folks that's out there and is thinking, man, I haven't done that yet because I need to go read all these Geiger books and these Junkyard Joe books and these giant-sized books, that's not the deal with these new ones. All three are great entry points. Don't be intimidated. You gotta check them out. So assuming you've read them, we will sally forth. But a couple of things. We got some thank yous, some people that we really want to recognize. First of all, the Ghost Machine Comics fan Facebook page that I recently joined has just been awesome. There's so many cool people in there. I really highly recommend you go join it if you're on Facebook. Do that. Very friendly folks. They're very active. They talk all day. One thing I wanted to shout out on there is there's a gentleman, Nick Churton. He had this Redcoat cosplay to commemorate the launch day at his local comic shop. And there's just sweet pictures on that Facebook group of him and on his Instagram too, which is under that name. So you certainly can find him there and check it out. Also, it's really neat. There's a bunch of retailers in that group that will kind of try to help give clarity on certain things, like how many, you know, 1 in 500 variants, is there going to be a 1 in 500 variant for a certain book, or 1 in 1,000 OMI variant for another book, etc. People have been saying that. And there's one other thing that was just thrown out there, and I'm not going to say who said it or what retailer said it, but it's the kind of thing you can't just toss this out there into my world. But somebody said that they legitimately heard the McFarlane Toys action figures of Ghost Machine characters were coming. And as a person that shelves many a McFarlane figure directly behind me right now, I can say that that would be epic. So who knows? One other thing that was really cool that I saw recently, just the other day, was the gentleman in the group had painted a miniature wolf with like radioactive eyes, and he made it look just like Bernie. That was absolutely cool. It made me want to play the Ghost Machine Technical Miniatures game that I just made up. But, you know, that'd be cool, like out in the wasteland or whatever. There's plenty of cool characters all across time with the unnamed that you could make into a, you know, miniatures game or whatever. That's a thing. They make everything to a miniatures game, I think, at some point nowadays. Also, a thank you so much to the folks at Ghost Machine Pro. The press crew over there, Kat and her team, have been awesome and very, very, very helpful and supportive to us. Also, Jason Fabach, this guy, went out of his way to post about the podcast on his page on Facebook. And we cannot tell you how much we thank you for that, Jason. Hopefully one day we can have you on here and we can have a conversation with you. Also, we've had a couple of supporters from like the creative team who've been liking or commenting on some of our Instagram posts. I said last time, oh, the Instagram is like it's a chintzy thing I got on the side to let people know that we're all like going to do this. Apparently that's a really big way that the kids communicate nowadays. That's not really a thing that I've used up until this point, but we're going to be using it. It looks like more and more. So take a look at our Instagram with what we've got going on every day there. It is so cool to see so many Ghost Machine creators liking stuff and posting stuff in that environment. So definitely check that out too. Also, a lot of people out there wearing the Threadless gear at threadless.com, where you can buy the clothes, the t-shirts and the coffee mugs and the hoodies and all that kind of stuff. I got a bunch of the t-shirts. But I was surprised, you know, that's not that it's not super cool. I bought a bunch of it. I just said, here's my money, you know, on that one. But they're not too expensive. They like run a different sale every week or whatever. And I would check it out. And that brings us to our first book. Let me set the scene for you. It's a full moon out, and you're Paul Revere, and a bunch of armed and conscripted Brits are on your tail. Your horse dashes up and down cobblestone streets while you yell the iconic, "The Redcoats are coming!" All of a sudden, someone gets lucky with a shot to the head, with a rock knocking you from your horse. And it's the Redcoats. They surround you, and just about when they're going to run you through, a swarm of iridescent fireflies erupts into the mouths of the British, whose skulls then explode with green fire. At which point, you are met with the most metal John Hancock ever, who reveals to you that the Founding Fathers have magical powers with which to bless America. Extremely metal John Hancock. Dude had a pirate earring and everything. That is the tone of this book that is masterfully set by creators Brian Hitch, fantastic artist who I have loved quite literally for decades since he first did The Authority. He's just absolutely awesome. And Jeff Johns, they work together as creators. Also, it looks like Andrew Curry did inks on this one. And as appears to be in the case of like almost all the Ghost Machine books right now, Brad Anderson is on colors. So it's gorgeous. Last but not least, Rob Lee is on letters. Letters are a big thing to be credited out there. Not everybody understands how important the letters are. They are super important. That being said, this book is not about Paul Revere. This book is about a random redcoat who then is fleeing the scene, trying to basically abandon his post, named Simon Pure, and about his inner monologue therein and where it goes. Right? We have seen him in a couple of cases before, and at times it's been unclear if really he had a sense of self-confidence or not, but he's always kind of admitted that he's got some sort of problem saving money and staying on the straight and narrow for whatever reason, even though he's hundreds of years old by the time he's recollecting all these stories. And so we see him running through the forest. It's a snowy forest. He's got who knows how many colonists behind him. He's got like dozens of them. He's got even people that are out of uniform following him. And this is when we see one of the first instances where he points out something self-deprecating, which is a reoccurring theme in this issue. He says, "I'm what some would call a coward, others a cheat, and to my fellow soldiers I deserted in Trenton an absconder, which I take as quite the compliment. Absconders live to see another day." And it's like, okay, I get it. I see where that's going. That's the idea right there. I mean, he's a transparent fella. But also, you know, this is going into a different part of the story. Everybody up until this point has been like, how did this guy become immortal? Because we saw in his previous appearances that at one point he shot George Washington, and George Washington gets back up after being killed with this power of the Founding Fathers emanating from an amulet, and he gets back up and he's fine. And that's when Simon says, you know, he learned about being an immortal from George Washington and his group or whatever. But nobody really knows what happened in all that time. And like, this series was originally supposed to come out, I think, in like 2022 or something. Like, I've seen old ads for it. So it's been a long time coming. People want to know what was going to happen next. And Simon gets away from the colonists. They go, he ends up in an old church, and then he notices like torches are flickering. He was passed out in the attic. And then he starts to hear these voices talking about things like getting their hoods on and did you find the ram's skull and all this kind of like, stuff. And then we see this scene where there's this, last time we talked about the launch of Image Comics and how many people would or wouldn't remember that listened to this. But if you remember the 1980s movie with Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd, Dragnet, there was this kind of like goofy evil guy group called the Pagans, and it stood for People Against Goodness and Normalcy. And they had like these goofy hoods, and some of them had these ram's head skull things, and it was very akin to this. It also reminded me of the Valiant comic Archer and Armstrong. There's a group called the 1% that's very similar to this. But he just happens to find himself asleep in this some sort of founding fathers ancient magical temple because there is a totem pole in it and all these other things. And it happens to be Benjamin Franklin that's about to get sacrificed in some manner to gain what would appear to be immortality, because the short version is it accidentally happens to Simon instead. And then it's shortly after that, we happen to find out some things about his death mechanic. I know all the role-playing gamers out there will probably like that one. It looks as though when he dies, it just takes him some time to wake back up, which is why he's actually woken up, like in being buried before, and he's had to crawl back out of it. But shortly after that, we kind of get a montage of all of his failures, which, you know, Brian Hitch and Jeff Johns do a pretty good job of trying to indicate are habitual. You know, he appears to be a bounty hunter slash assassin that repeatedly kills people, and then people that care about those people come hunt him down, and then he has to run away. And he admits that, like he said, absconders live to see another day, and he's very good at, he literally says on a full page splash page that he is magnificent in a retreat. So he repeatedly kills people that come looking for him. And then in a totally different part of the book, we see that he has a young lady at the local whatever tavern that he's at on the outs with him. And it looks like that's a trend for him as well. It shows like every half a century or so, he ends up getting slapped by a different woman. Like you can see the montage happening as if it was a film or whatever. It's just one thing after another with this guy. It's almost to the point where, you know, it's impressive that he can fight off a lot of people at times, but then he really just keeps saying, I'm only doing it so I can get away. So you're waiting for the other shoe to drop. You're waiting for the creators to be like, here are all these negative qualities that this person who stumbled into immortality has. So here's this interesting circumstance that he's going to be in that makes you want to learn more about him or how he's going to redeem himself or something to that effect, because obviously he's been doing it century after century after century and that expectation's already set. So something different is definitely going to be happening now. And the way that they steer in that direction most likely is the way that the book ends, which is him waking back up after being buried dead, but regenerating per se. And he says, it's interesting. He says he figured out a while back how to not freak out and how to dig himself out of being buried alive, which is sounds terrifying, but instead he doesn't have to, because in this instance, Albert Einstein, a very young Albert Einstein, it'd be interesting to see exactly how many years old he would have been in this year. Albert Einstein was born in 1879 and this is 1892. He's a 13-year-old Albert Einstein. So he wakes him up, gets him out of this hole. He's like, hey, my English is bad because I've only been able to study for 3 days. I should have done it in 2, but I was distracted. So it's like, yeah, okay, you're Albert Einstein. But then he says he needs his help, his magical help to stop a great evil. And then the dudes with the goofy ram skulls and the hoods show up with loaded weapons. And that's where we pause for the next issue. It's interesting because it seems as though Einstein will be the reader's entry into, you know, what's the next stage about Simon Pure, aka Redcoat, that's going to make him interesting to read about, other than the fact that he's a womanizer and an assassin who is very bad at saving money, which admittedly, there are a couple of things that they do point out. They say that it appears as though, due to the magical nature of his immortality, two very specific things. He is unable to save money, like maintain finances, I guess, like or really an estate of any kind. And he is forever famished. Like no matter how much he eats, he is always like constantly hungry. That would be really bad for me. Often people will say, like, what superpower do you want? Everybody says, like, telekinesis, invisibility, flight. I always say immortality. But immortality with hangry forever? Absolutely not. No, thank you. Like, when you talk about like on some sort of disadvantage chart about how it affects this person in combat on a daily basis, the constant famished, no good. I am sorry, no good. Either way, very excited to see what happens with Simon and Einstein. Like, that's cool. That's a juxtaposition that makes me think, all right, that's why this story is going somewhere new and it's worth having an ongoing series from Ghost Machine Comics about. Next, we have what to me was like Going Home, which is Geiger, number one. But there was something a little bit different about the way it felt as it started. Pilgrim. Had a western feel to it. Some folks in a desert town looked like they were having trouble with some ruffians, some bandits, some bullies. And Tariq was there reading a book. Sounds like he went there, grabbed a book. They didn't know he was the glowing man because he had no reason to take his boron rods out and transform. But what's one of those cool things that has happened several times in previous issues of Geiger is when the point of combat arises, you just get a page that says Geiger in between Tariq looking at the bandits who decided that they're going to go ahead and mercilessly attack the town and take their children. And the next very, the very next page is this absolutely gorgeous Gary Frank splash page with like the bandits on the ground. One of them's face is just melted from a radioactive hand and the other guy is smoking. The other one is en route off screen because he's stuck on his horse, but you can tell in the upper left of this beautiful panel that he fell and got stuck in his horse, so he keeps going. And it's the motion of the horse's tail and everything, it's so cinematic. It's really neat because you can see it happening as it goes. It's not, you know, this is not just a cartoon or whatever people call it, call a comic book sometimes. This is awesome. And so point being that there was very little breakdown of the combat in that case, but shortly thereafter, there's one bad guy left and he's got hold of a child, and Tariq has to have his superhero moment where he tosses his rod and saves the child with meticulous accuracy. Then we have the reoccurring theme with his character as well, which is where he'll do something good. And then because of what he is, he's this glowing radioactive man in a world where people have to wear suits and or at least masks to breathe. Otherwise, they'll inhale radioactivity in the air. They don't really want to be around him, even if he did something great for them. So then he has to leave. And he's followed by a friend, and we find out something cool about Barney. But first, there is a detail, and this is one of the other very cool things about creator-owned comics, and especially the type of creators that Jeff Johns and Gary Frank are. That's who created Geiger. That's who wrote and illustrated this book. Brad Anderson, again, did the colors on this one, which we're going to talk about very specifically for a moment as well. And it looks like Rob Lee did the letters. So Rob Lee is a busy Ghost Machine letterist. The one thing that I really want to say about the Brad Anderson color art is that it is so striking that you can tell the weather and the time of day by how the background looks and how it reflects off of the buildings and the people's shadows. You can actually get a sense of that because of how he uses color. It's very amazing. So this is what I wanted to point out about the creators of Ghost Machine. They have this book and it gets like two panels. So it's got to be a significant thing. You don't give something two panels and be like, it's just there. It's just a red book. That guy's reading a red book. Who cares? No, that doesn't make any sense. So Tariq is reading a book called Blood Meridian, also sometimes called The Evening, Redness in the West, which is a Cormac McCarthy Western, which has a lot of conflicting ideas about whether it's a traditional Western. And the very short version is it has a lot of parallels to Tariq's story based on at least the Wikipedia entry. So it's probably kind of a little nod to anybody who wants to look that up, and or perhaps if one were to be more familiar with the book Blood Meridian, it may be some sort of forecast of something coming. So then Chirik leaves town. And now here's something also, another detail, a very specific detail they put in. There's like a page of the comic book is dedicated to this. He's eating with Barney. Reminder, Barney is his two-headed radioactive wolf that helps protect him and do cool stuff with him. Up until this point, we have seen Barney like attack Nightcrawler, giant bug things, and we've seen him eat beans, and we've seen him like there's been nothing specific about his diet or his biology that's been talked about. It was just that he was a two-headed radioactive dog, and that's all we really knew. And he at one point, like I think he indicated he didn't want to eat any more beans. That was it. That was a while back, like literally years. Because remember, the first Geiger series came out in 2021, April of 2021. It's been 3 years. What's interesting about this section is that Tariq says to Barney, when Barney doesn't want to eat the beans he's cooking while they're camping out, he says, if you eat the animals out here, you'll get sick again, even with that radioactive stomach. And then he's like, ah, and he's like, growl all you want, blah. And so that's telling us a detail for a specific reason. It's telling us that Barney is not invincible, I'm assuming. Or like there's got to be a reason that Geoff Johns would put that detail in there. They want us to remember that for whatever reason. It's going to be significant later. So I dig that. That's cool. Duly noted. And what's interesting is the last remnant of the Nuclear Knights of Camelot in Las Vegas, circa 2050, there's this guy who used to be called Hazmat. I believe it was Hazmat because there were two guys. One was Hazmat, one was Warhead. Warhead had black armor, and Hazmat is this one. He's also the guy that has talked to Redcoat in 2050 prior to this when he thought he wanted to hire someone to kill Tariq. But in this case, he's trying to catch up with him because he says he wants to be like him. And he wants to emulate him because he saw him sacrificing himself to save the lives of some children. And he's turning over a new leaf. It's kind of funny. And they get all the way to the point where Tariq is like, no, this is a terrible world, whatever, go away. And then Hazmat sets his sword up on top of some rocks. And he's going to fall on it. And I don't know the joke here, but it's pretty funny because he says, I wanted you to just go back to Las Vegas when I told you to get out of here and not commit seppuku. And he's like, I thought it was called Hari Kari. I can't do anything right. And I don't know which one it is or what the difference is. I think one of them you fall on it. The other one you like have to do it to yourself and turn it around. It sounds horrible. They both sound horrible. If you happen to know the answer to that one, shoot me an email at ghostmachinefans@gmail.com. So Nate is his name. We find that out. It is no longer going to be Haz or Hazmat like it was back in his days of serving the King of Camelot, who is now deceased. And he's going to essentially be like, if Tariq is Don Quixote, then Nate's going to be Sancho Panza. Is kind of the way it looks as they walk off into the sunset. But at the end, we see what could potentially be a new cameo, or I'm totally just missing it, but it doesn't look like anybody that we had seen in other issues. There's this person that is clearly tracking him, and they can sense Tariq somehow because he picks up a flower that Tariq was like looking at or had touched, and he zaps it, and then he says, I'm close. But we don't see his face, we just see his hand. We see his vehicle, which is clearly like a big armored vehicle with a minigun on top. Like he's ready to roll. So he's looking for somebody. I'm assuming he's looking for Geiger. This book, let me tell you, it was like coming home. Even though altogether we've only had the equivalent of what, like 9 to 10 Geiger issues of anything, because we had Geiger 1 through 6, we had the Geiger 80 page giant, and we had some of his stuff that was in Ghost Machine #1 a little bit. We also had Geiger Ground Zero 1 and 2 to tell us a little bit more about his origin with Dr. Molotov, and we're going to have a separate episode about those. But this was awesome. It was nice to see a new layer added, maybe a little bit of levity, because it is a sad story, and we did still see some of that, Tariq thinking about his family and stuff like that, and that's an integral part of his character. But it was cool to see a new relationship kind of door open, and we'll see where that goes. As I recall, the robot, aka Junkyard Joe, should be out there somewhere in 2050. I would love to see him pop up again. Definitely recommend Geiger number one with the Western feel. It's cool. And last but certainly not least, we come to our third ongoing series that launched last Wednesday, which is Rook Exodus. Now, I have a bone to pick with a certain Jason Fabok out there. For some time now, I've been very excited and dedicated to this whole unnamed continuity deal. A lot of people are. And then I picked this book up. I thought the Ghost Machine number one stuff was cool. The art is amazing, for sure. But this book, man, this book is making me cheap on Geiger and Junkyard Joe and Redcoat. Because this book, by a slim margin, decent margin, was my favorite of the three, for sure. Blew me away. You know, I'd been wondering, like, is that going to be a standalone thing? Like, they have all these other things, but then it's getting all these different variant covers, and, whew, man, I really enjoyed this book. So, let me just tell you who made the book, and then I'll gush over the book some more in hopefully a way that makes you laugh a little bit. So this one is a Jeff Johns and Jason Fabok joint. I mentioned Mr. Fabok earlier. Thanks again for your support of the show. Brad Anderson colored this one. I think Brad Anderson is actually like a clone of robots named Brad Anderson, and they have like crayon fingers on one cyborg hand, and the other one must be like paintbrushes, because this dude colors every single one of these comic books. And Rob Lee on letters again. Again, letters are super important. Don't forget. So when you open this book straight up, one of the very cool things about comics being a visual storytelling element is instead of having to have a long, you know, drawn out explanation of what the situation is, it just gives you this readout font is what I would say. Like, I can imagine the click, click, clickety click of the keys going by as this reads out to you. You know, it's like the kind of thing that Ripley would see on the Nostromo on like a screen that came on. The overhead computer would sound something like this. The Kepler system, Planet F, was purchased by Better World Corporation in the year 2152. 1 year later, Better World rebranded the planet Exodus. 6 years after that, the planet was colonized by Betterworld's first visitors in the year 2159. Unfortunately, 11 years later, the Earth engine terraforming Planet F failed, and Betterworld was evacuated 1 year later. And I imagine that whatever the source of that electronic communication was would explode and be gone, and we could carry on with our tale. Now, the panel doesn't even say all that. The panel just basically says when it was purchased, when it was rebranded, and when it was colonized, and when it was evacuated. That was just me making you tolerate that for a minute. Thanks for sticking with us, kids. But it says a lot, and that's what a comic book can do. It also reminds me of, in the beginning of Blade Runner, how there's that readout about the replicants and the Terrell Corporation and all that kind of stuff. We understand. We can infer from this that we are entering from post-evacuation point. And we know from the stories that we've read in Rook's bio and Direwolf's bio and Swine's bio, all of which were sweet, and in Ghost Machine number one, that when the Better World Corporation left and their terraforming engine failed, they basically left employees and people that were unimportant or did not necessitate the departure of those who were able to afford leaving behind. And one of those groups of people are called wardens. And the reason that wardens were needed is because a large part of the terraforming process
that they were going through involved controlling and manipulating nature to even to the extent of being able to control the animals. There were a lot of these wardens that would get these helmets that would allow them to control various animal types. And a la Voltron, the helmets do look like, you know, the animal or whatever. So we have our main character, Rook, and he controls ravens, rooks, and crows, like we've mentioned before. And he has this cool, like, crow-looking helmet and all this kind of stuff, and crows flying around it. The premise of the issue is that he's trying to scavenge enough parts to put his rocket together. So every time somebody else tries to shoot a rocket off to get off that planet and they fail and it crashes, he goes out and he tries to scavenge the parts, as it were. So he goes out there and he does that. And we learn rather quickly, you know, even though he'll get stuck on these panels, man, that the Fabok art is awesome. Even stuff that's just like wilderness scenes, you're like, man, look at all the detail in there. You could take all the time in the world. Look at these panels. Take your time. Ultimately, though, there's obviously a story here, and he goes to the crash site. He has some difficulty finding what he needs because he doesn't have his friend with his giant warthogs, because the warthogs have a good sniffer to find the parts that he needs, apparently. But he does find a survivor who, well, brief survivor, we can say. And this is where we start to be able to pull back the tapestry of this world, right? So he says about the guy he's found dying. He has a big piece of shrapnel through him. Doesn't look like he's savable. Says, going by the uniform, he was one of the weathermen. They looked down on the wardens, at least the ones I met. So right there, there's some sort of implication of some kind of maybe a class system, or at least within the workforce. But it's interesting because Rook pulls out some painkillers, even though he knows the guy's going to die. And Rook even says, he's like, this is my last one, but I'm going to give it to him. He's that much of a empathetic person that he's going to make that kind of sacrifice. Who knows what he could use those for? There's barely anybody left on this entire planet. He has painkiller medicine. He's going to use it on a guy who's going to die in seconds to help it not be so harsh, which is pretty cool of that character. But then it turns out he's like, no, take this bound bunch of papers or books or whatever. Rook isn't sure because he doesn't open it. Because in that moment, a massive grizzly bear, like house-sized grizzly bear, that might even be bigger than that, somehow catches him off guard and comes out of the smoke. That's probably why. Lots of loud smoke and fire and smells and stuff. It's hard to keep track of those giant grizzly bears. And, you know, he gets attacked by him, and you get to see some more amazing Fabok art and some more Brad Anderson amazing colors. And this is when they do begin to explain a little bit more about the world as well and why these animals are so big. It's not just because it looks cool. Apparently, the animals began to grow when the world engine stopped, when the technology began to cease that was allowing them to terraform. That means, in Rook's opinion, that it was one of two things. It was either that the size of the planet was different than Earth and they couldn't scale to that once the animals were born or created or whatever without the machine being on. Or the other one is the water made them that way. So, you know, water or world machine, but the fake water, like there's something wrong with the water and it wasn't naturally made or something of that nature. Get some insight about that. And then we also learn a little bit more about the mechanics of the warden's helmets, because he realizes the only way he's going to get away from this big giant house bear is if he calls in his crows to like distract it and frustrate it. So it'll go away. So, you know, he will survive. Then we begin to get an idea of how the neural connection of the helmet and him to the animals is taking a toll on him, which we explore quite a bit. And it leads, for now, to him just explaining that the creators, the inventors of the technology, called it instinct influence, and that it was supposed to be something that allowed him to influence, you know, the animals that he had this connection to do certain things. But it appears that there's some sort of feedback that affects the wearer of the helmets as well. So he goes back home, and that's where we start to get a whole bunch of awesome visual storytelling. I just would love to read the Geoff Johns script for some of these pages, because it's a great example of how a comic book can do only with pictures a lot of storytelling. And people don't realize that, you know, this isn't just like Jason Fabok drew this guy doing some things, walking down hallways and interacting with objects. Jeff Johns and he worked together to determine how that was going to be shown to us. And so what happens is he has to go shopping. Rook has to go shopping. And the way that Rook goes shopping is he goes to this big abandoned city that he stays at called New Mason. And you see him drive by a couple of apartment buildings. And the apartment buildings have doors with red X's on them. And then he gets to one that doesn't have a red X. And he goes inside. Then he walks down some hallways. A bunch of the doors have red X's on them. Then there's one that doesn't. And he walks inside. And then in there, there's a fresh cabinet full of like canned goods, because in Ghost Machine comics, everybody has to eat canned goods and alcohol, typically. And so then he takes it out, does it again. And then we see this visually represented with little to no dialogue. And it's just awesome. It's just awesome, awesome, awesome. But then we see that continuing to occur and him having to come back and him then starting to mention how he has to clear his head more and more because of the pain that stays with him because of the connection to his animals. And so we do see this character seeming to becoming, you know, drinking more and more to facilitate being able to focus or not focus on this pain or whatever it exactly is. And it's clearly a very challenging thing and a painful thing for him. He gets in touch with Swine, who is like, hey, come out to my jungle pad. It's okay that there's no water left and everybody's going to die soon. I just found a case full of liquor and we can drink it all, which is me being a little funny, but it is pretty much what happens. And at this point, they even do show that in a matter of days, one of the bodies of water nearby has truly dried up, like all the fish are out and everything. So you do get to have a little bit more back and forth between Swine and Rook, a bit more about their relationship. It does appear that Swine has a different relationship with his quote-unquote drift than Rook does. Reminder, drift seems to be what they use as a colloquialism for their animal crew. So like Swine's drift is these warthogs, only one of which has he named, and he has named like only one of which has he said the name of that we are aware of, and that one is called Pumbaa. So it makes you wonder. I mean, I'll take it. Whatever. As long as there's no Timon, we'll take Pumbaa. I'm sure there'll be a Timon joke one day. Rook's drift are the crows or whatever. What are the rooks, ravens, and crows that might be around him, right? And then we do get a little bit of a flashback origin story about Rook. It looks like he and his dad had a good relationship, but unfortunately something happened to their farm. And as a result of that, he got extorted to accept a certain amount of money and leave the planet and go to the new place, even though he really was challenged in doing so. Like when he was leaving, this is another thing about this character. Like this character has inherently good or noble qualities. And one of them is that they're trying to show you that when he left, he felt very guilty about doing so, just with some more visual storytelling. Like he sees some people that aren't able to leave and he's in the line of people that are leaving because he basically accepted a bribe, but didn't know what to do. And it's just interesting to me. It's a cool character. I feel like there's a lot that this character can do. Watch, I say that and Ghost Machine will like kill him off in the fourth issue or something because everyone's hardcore. I don't know. Probably not. They wake up the next day hungover around the campfire. All the buggies are torn up and messed up. The warthogs are running everywhere. There's one ripped apart in the ground. And then there's this just massive swarm of Jason Fabok tapestry house bears that attack everybody, and it is an amazing splash page. I know there's some small panels on the bottom, so it's not like a full splash page, but it's just so cool. Props to everybody involved in making that page of comic books right there. Holy moly. And then in typical Image fashion, the last page is the first cameo appearance of a new character. Yeah, it says next, the power of Ursaw, U-R-S-A-W, and he's holding Swine's helmet. It doesn't look like his head. I don't think he ripped his head off, but he's holding his helmet in his hand. And he's clearly a warden, clearly the bear warden. So all those crazy bears were listening to this guy. It is really cool. It's super metal. Makes me think of the end of like Stormwatch or Spawn or something back in the day of that nature. Beautiful book, great story, great visual storytelling. Really excited to see where it goes. Didn't see Direwolf in this one at all. She seems like she's going to be a pretty cool character, so looking forward to that as well.
As the music rolls, I beseech you to check out www.ghostmachinefans.com, where you can find our wiki, forums, and Instagram, where we truly would love for you to come say hi. Also, keep an eye out for the Twitter that we are starting. Friend of the show, Cameron, is going to be putting that together. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ghost Machine Fans Podcast.